Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, but in for Amy on this Thanksgiving Eve is John Cass, johncassnews.com. is where you find his columns as well as the Chicago Way podcast. Happy
Good
Thanksgiving
morning,
to everyone. And John?
Good morning, sir.
Sir, do you still celebrate, or did you ever? I don't know. I'm asking. Thesmophoria? Isn't that what the ancient Greeks celebrated in lieu of Thanksgiving? I mean, not in lieu of Thanksgiving, because, of course, it preceded it. But, right? This when I'm not joking.
Well, why don't you open up on a treatise of Pythagoras and the beans.
Well, this is when Hades kidnapped Persephone and
yes.
Demeter couldn't, right? And
yes.
Couldn't feed the world and winter descended. Is that, that's a thing?
Yes, it is a thing. It's called winter. And then when the mother is happy that her daughter is safe, she can see her daughter and she comes up for those few months, and she's happy, and the mother smiles.
Okay.
On the earth.
All right. So how do you celebrate Thesmophoria?
We used to celebrate by killing a bunch of rabbits and pheasants, and then, stewing them with garlic and salt and pepper.
Yeah. Doing them with garlic and, you mean
you know, in
them?
A stew, yeah, cooking
yeah.
them, right?
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah. Interesting. Mm-hmm. Well, since we're waxing mythological, can we wax philosophical on this Thanksgiving Eve for just a moment? Because I like these editorials. I'm sure I've mentioned them before.
Did I write this?
No, you did not write this. But I like these editorials that appear every year in the Wall Street Journal. At least one since 1961. The first is just a portion of it. The account of the pilgrim's journey to Plymouth in 1620, as recorded by Nathaniel Morton, as told by William Bradford. All right.
I'm following you so far.
Now, they've already departed from Amsterdam, and they're crossing the high seas. The account goes like this: being now past the vast ocean and a sea of troubles before them and expectations, they had now no friends to welcome them, no inns to entertain or refresh them, no houses or much less towns to repair unto to seek for succor, and for the season it was winter, and they that know the winters of the country know them to be sharp and violent, subject to cruel and fierce storms, dangerous to travel to known places, much more to search unknown coasts. Besides, what could they see but a hideous and desolate wilderness, full of wild beasts and wild men, and what multitudes of them were there? They that knew not, for which way soever they turned their eyes, save upward to heaven, they could have but little solace or content in respect of any outward object, for summer being ended, all things stand in appearance with a weather-beaten face, and the whole country, full of woods and thickets, represented a wild and savage hue. If they looked behind them, there was a mighty ocean which they had passed, and was now a main bar or gulf to separate them from all the civil parts of the world. That's a pretty literate account of this journey, vivid, I would say.
It's on the verge of romanticizing nature, but yes.
And there's now this editorial that the Wall Street Journal has been running since 1961. And The Fair Land, it's entitled. Uh-huh. And just a passage or two from this as well. I mean, just the trajectory of thinking and scholarship and then we'll fast forward to today and be depressed. But we'll get there. We'll get there.
You're going to pull a Chicago editorial? Yeah.
We can remind ourselves, this from and the Fairland, we can remind ourselves that for all our social discord, we yet remain the longest enduring society of free men governing themselves without benefit of kings or dictators. Being so, we are the marvel and the mystery of the world, for that enduring liberty is no less a blessing than the abundance of the earth. And we might remind ourselves also that if those men setting out from Delfshaven, the pilgrims, had been daunted by the troubles they saw around them, then we could not this autumn be thankful for a fair land. See, the connection to history,
yes,
in addition to the wonderful prose. Now, where do we stand in 2022, do you ask? Thank you for asking.
Well, I'm just eager with anticipation.
This Thanksgiving, the Oatly Emotional Support Hotline for plant-based eaters will offer unique resources for vegans looking for support during this challenging holiday.
Is that an editorial in Chicago?
No.
I would assume it would be one of the Chicago papers.
I mean, it's not an editorial, but it is a commentary, if you know what I'm saying.
Yes, I do.
When you call this emotional helpline, if you're a plant eater on this Thanksgiving holiday, first, you can listen to the main menu in different formats, including in English or Swedish. Of course, English or Swedish.
Right.
Accompanied by smooth jazz or elevator music.
You have stolen our dreams?
Yeah. You know, so, accompanied by smooth jazz or elevator music. Or perfect. Read by a fifth grader from Kansas who won a Thanksgiving essay contest. I'm not kidding.
I would rather have the child read because the wisdom of children.
Oh, sure. Thou shall lead, yes. Pressing one will get you to personal affirmations to help emotionally navigate a traditional meat and dairy heavy Thanksgiving dinner. Pressing four will get you to a locker room style motivational speech inspired by the film Rudy. On the other tools on the hotline include tips about weaving the benefits of plant-based eating into conversation and deflection tactics when the conversation gets too daunting.
Deflection tactics.
Yeah.
You mean like when your uncle's talking about, why don't you like steak? Are you American or not?
Right.
American?
Yeah, so I guess something like that. Right. Have a piece of turkey. Just try one piece. So I just thought as I'm reading, thinking about the holiday a bit, I enjoy those essays that are published annually in the Wall Street Journal. I just from 1620 to even 1961 to 2022, I feel like we sort of fell off the edge in the last 40 or 50 years. I don't know about you.
There was a literary tradition that reached back over time, and now we have deflection hotlines and 5- and 6-year-olds reading.
Emotional support for the plant-based eaters among us.
This is the nation, the greatest nation on earth, that God, in his wisdom and love for man, gave us dominion over, correct? I mean, yes, manifest destiny and all that. Okay, I'm cool with it. But now we're, I don't know what, we've removed our own spines and we become like slugs. I don't know.
Well, we don't have the protein to stand upright because we're all plant eaters now. That's the problem. Dan and John Cass in for Amy on this edition, this Thanksgiving Eve edition of Chicago's Morning Answer.
Listen to Dan and Amy on your smartphone. Download the AM560 mobile app today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Hey, business owners, is your business and money in good hands? Does your bank invest in your success? Hi, Mike Gallagher here, letting you know that when you need a relationship bank, Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. I love these guys. Not only do they have expansive industry experience, a strong financial track record, but they're also highly capitalized for strategic growth. That's so important. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. They know what it means to grow a business by designing solutions that are right for you and only you. These are real people. They're ready to help. So reach out to my friends at Signature Bank. Make the call today. 773-467-5630. 773-467-5630. Or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Your business could be Signature Bank's next success story. Go online, signaturebank.bank. Member FDIC. Equal housing lender. Signature Bank.
If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan, and John Cass is in for Amy J this morning. She's, I'm sure, making all the fixings for Thanksgiving dinner tomorrow, and let's all pray for the Jacobson family if Amy is indeed cooking.
Watch the stuffing.
There you go. JohnCastNews.com, of course, for all of John's work. So updating the situation in the aftermath of that horrific shooting over the weekend at the gay bar in Colorado Springs. And also, as a quick aside, we'll be updating you as information becomes available about another mass shooting this yesterday night in Chesapeake, Virginia, where the report now is that seven people were murdered at a Walmart in Chesapeake, Virginia, when apparently, it's being reported from an eyewitness, a Walmart employee opened fire on patrons and then turned the gun on himself. So, as more information about that equally horrific event is available, we'll pass it along, of course. So, there's the development yesterday in the Colorado Springs case. The shooter, who is in custody, identifies as non-binary. There was a representation made in court by the public defender representing the shooter. He is non-binary. Well, they use his name. I'm saying he. They use, this is quoting, they use they, them pronouns, and for the purposes of all formal filings, will be addressed as Mix. Instead of Mr. or Miss MX. This was a footnote in a court filing.
Is that approved by the Cambridge Dictionary or just a legal phenomenon?
Well, the interesting part about this is then the reporting yesterday on the shooter all refers to the shooter when they refer to him by using pronouns. They refer to him as they and them. Because, of course, the you know, that's the new and improved AP style. So does that change our understanding at all of what happened here? This hate crime inspired by right-wing, incendiary right-wing rhetoric against the LGBTQ plus community. That's the narrative that's being by the D.C. press corps.
Not only
and now we find out that the shooter identifies as non-binary, so part of the gender spectrum that's supposedly represented by the LGBTQ plus leftists. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-36DA, turnkey.pro text line. In addition to that, Denver Post reporting, this young man has had an interesting life. We know, and we've talked about the bomb threat that required a police response last year. And again, no charges were ever filed. I'm still trying to get my mind around why that was the case. He wasn't a minor. In addition to that, I mean, not that if a minor makes a bomb threat, they can be charged too. But this was a bomb threat that was made against his mother. The police showed up to the house. He wasn't there. They located him in another house. He wouldn't come out, so there was a three-hour standoff. And he was arrested but never prosecuted. I don't know why.
Were the rules bent because he was to be protected or what?
We don't know. Also, just more of his personal history coming out. According to the Denver Post, he changed his name. He changed his name in Bexar County, Texas, 6 years ago when he was 15, more than 6 years ago. He was living in San Antonio at the time, and the grandparents signed off on the petition authorizing the name change. The family wrote he wanted to change his name to protect himself and his future from any connections to the birth father, to his birth father, and his birth father's criminal history. His father has had no contact with him for several years. I don't know exactly what his father's criminal history is, but mom and dad divorced when he was an infant, and mom is still around and involved, but I don't know why it was the grandparents that were the custodial parent, the custodial guardian, back when he changed his name in Texas 7 years ago, a little bit more than 6 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And then they somehow got to Colorado, and mom is involved again based on some of the reporting about them going to gun ranges and such together.
Well, mommy wanted to bond with her non-binary child, right?
Well, the point
9mm.
Well, the point is to say this, as is often the case, almost always the case,
right.
This is a lot more complicated than it appears at first blush. And the way this is being reported is, well, it's
white Christian danger, right? Isn't that the thrust of the reporting?
Well, and who's the responsible party? The responsible party, Tucker Carlson, Lauren Boebert, Matt Walsh, libs of TikTok, the right wing hate machine. When in point of fact, it's a left wing hate machine that demagogues incidents like this for the purpose of people losing their ability to reason, so they fall in with the left, because that's the only way you can fall in with these people, if you suspend your ability to reason or you lose it altogether.
Lightfoot, Lori Lightfoot, the mayor of Chicago, that just the other day after this horrific event happened, tweeted out the following: I'm sick of this shit. How many people need to be murdered? How many lives torn apart until it actually stops? We don't have to live like this, and we don't have to die like this. Mm-hmm. But the implication is that it's, you know, directed politically. The violence is politically directed, and apparently it wasn't. Or, as you say, it was more complicated than we thought.
Despite that information coming out, this is how committed they are to this storyline. And there is no amount of facts or evidence that will dissuade them. Here's Ben Collins, NBC News, yesterday.
Events recently, like, for example, the Proud Boys will go and protest any drag brunch, any drag story hour, anything that a child might go to meet a drag queen, not, you know, just to show them that they're human beings and people. They talk, they go there and they read Dr. Seuss there. They read regular books, but it's read by a drag queen, and they, you know, they have breakfast. It is not some hypersexual event, but that's what it's viewed as on the far right. And these spaces have become dangerous places of real-life information warfare. There's Proud Boys showing up on one side. Sometimes people, like local Antifa members, show up on the other side as a way to... It becomes a place where kids aren't safe, not because of the event itself, but because of this culture war that's been propped up on top of it. And that's not something that should happen. This is not something, you know, these people should be able to live their lives without fear of being murdered, literally. But right now, that's the sort of climate that's been created by anti-LGBTQ protesters and, frankly, bigots.
Who is the soy boy talking?
Yeah, your typical NBC reporter, just playing it right down the middle. Reciting facts.
Because there's nothing asexual or non-sexual about a drag queen in a library with kids.
Especially when they're dressed like strippers.
Yeah, or feather boas and wiggling their behinds,
yeah.
Right? Isn't that part of it?
Well, that's a more descriptive version, but yeah, basically.
This whole thing, you know, anybody, if you avail yourselves of American media, basically you're a moron.
Just listen to the. Let me give you a few examples here. So there's Ben Collins, you know, your standard issue DC press corps reporter, mm-hmm. in quotation marks.
Mm-hmm.
Here's Sarah Kate Ellis. She's the CEO of GLAAD. This is the Gay Lesbian Alliance Against Defamation.
Mm-hmm. Let's hear it.
The rhetoric that's coming out from politicians, they're using our community as political footballs, and they're spreading lies and hate about our community. Just this past year alone, there have been over 300 anti-LGBTQ bills proposed, 300 against a community that's not looking for anything. So I think there's that. DeSantis, Boebert, they have blood on their hands on this. They have to stop spreading lies. These are lies that they're spreading, and they're causing pain and death and murder against our community.
Can't they speak without sing-song in their voice? Like, because the people who are being attacked, there's 600 pieces of legislation affecting us? Why do they do that? Why do they do that? Okay, I've had it with these people. I don't know what to say, Dan.
300 pieces of legislation. Right, you mean like we don't want to teach graphic sexual material, don't want to instruct on graphic sexual issues
for your
K through third graders, which is the law in that was passed by, you know,
DeSantis
and Republicans in Florida.
Right.
So now he has blood on his hands for what happened in Colorado Springs. That's anti-LGBTQ. I mean, they don't want anything either, says Sarah Kate Ellis. Well, it seems like they do, because they want to propagandize
the children of America. How's that?
Well, you call it anti-LGBTQ when someone opposes your effort to insinuate yourself in a place that is inappropriate,
right?
With material that is inappropriate or performances that are inappropriate. Is it anti-LGBTQ when a legislature moves to prohibit the use of puberty blockers for minors because, and this is the science, because the long-term effects of puberty blockers are not known, and there's good reason to believe there are a lot of potential negative consequences from the use of puberty blockers, and so we should pause before we run headlong into just giving the kids whatever they want, putting them in charge of their own health and their own medical decisions in a way that we don't on almost anything else outside of abortion and gender reassignment. So is that anti-LGBT? Because if it is, I mean, because if that's what you're saying is anti-LGBT legislation, then you do want something. And we want something, and other people want something else. And so we're having this debate and discussion and, yes, cultural fight over it. That makes it anti-LGBTQ. That means we're not recognizing the humanity of a gay person or trans person. Absurd. Absurd on its face, but it's interesting to listen to the rhetoric, so understand what they're doing, because this impacts how people understand these issues, or more to the point, don't understand them and just lead with their feelings, run out, put their hate has no home sign in their yard in Naperville and vote for Marxists. It's never specific. It's just hate, anti-LGBTQ, targeting our population. We don't want anything. It's just brunch. So on and so forth. It's a bunch of nonsense.
It's just reading at the library. It's not some man with wearing fishnet stockings and a feather boa talking to your five-year-old and wiggling his ass in the library.
Frank Figliuzzi, who I want to get back on the show. Let's see how tough this guy is, because he comes off real tough on MSNBC. Uh-huh. I think we've had him on the show once before, but it was before he completely lost his mind. Frank Figliuzzi is a former assistant director of counterintelligence at the FBI.
Uh-huh.
This is what he said on MSNBC yesterday.
This toxic mix of hatred plus clinging to assault weapons is the laziest way. Targeting your opponent, targeting what you don't like, is the laziest way out. And seemingly they think the easiest way to just make what you don't like go away. But the senator's got this right. It is about instilling fear. And the correct response for the rest of us is to step up and push back right at them. So it's hatred. It's clinging to weapons. It's ignorance of the other, demonizing the other. We've said this over and over again. But strategically, what appears to be happening is they want to deny people the safe haven and safe harbor, whether we're talking about kids in schools feeling unsafe because of guns. Black churches feeling like they're going to get shot up at a Bible study has happened in South Carolina. Whether it's synagogues, whether it's the gay club on a weekend night, there seems to be a concerted effort to not only instill fear, but deny the safe places. And that puts them in control. And then the theory is, if you're fearful enough, you're not going to push back. If he's a consumer of the people we just rattled off, from Lauren Boebert to Tucker Carlson, let's get it out. Let's get it out at trial. Let's expose it for what it is, name it and shame it. He's a consumer of these people, and those people should face civil consequences from the victims.
Wait a second. Is this a representative of the American Stasi who grew up and spent years with the FBI, basically hating people who speak their minds?
Well, you can understand why the FBI is so politicized and, yes, and therefore corrupt when people like Figliuzzi were in positions of authority. So Tucker Carlson, you know, at least he only wants to have Tucker Carlson, Lauren Boebert, you know, civilly liable, you know, for the wrongful deaths of the people who were murdered in Colorado Springs. You know, others, blood on their hands and criminally liable. Yeah. But listen to what he said. Listen to the approach. These people are the strategy is this, and they're conspiring to do that. Like anybody who disagrees with the use of puberty blockers for minors or boys and girls sports or the sexualized curricula for primary grades, you're conspiring with the shooter of Club Q, the man who shot and killed those people at Club Q in Colorado Springs. We're in it together. This is strategic. This is what they do. It's the classic smear politics. You voted for Trump, you're a January 6th insurrectionist. You oppose the erasure of all lines between adult and child, then you're, you know, conspiring with hate-mongering mass murderers to kill LGBTQ people. This is how unhinged they are, how unreasonable they are, how anti-intellectual they are. And the people who need to stand up are the people who are commonsensical and are being smeared by people like Frank Figliuzzi.
How about the parents? Parents standing up.
Well, that's what I'm talking about.
Parents standing up at school board elections. That's a good start. You've been talking about this for the past several days. Isn't that a way to stand up? Beginning to stand up?
I mean, it's just remarkable the gall they have to make these comparisons and to suggest that you know, conservative talk show hosts or politicians have blood on their hands, should be civilly liable for the deaths that occurred. And so, I mean, they're so irresponsible. They are purposely completely distorting the positions that commonsensical people, even if they don't conservative or not,
right,
commonsensical people have about this gender identitarian political ideology that's being advanced by the left.
Okay, but is anger the right response, or is it like questioning whether or not this is basically the same thing as asking the knight in Monty Python if wood floats, then she's a witch and you can burn her? I mean, isn't that the logic of this demented man?
Well, maybe we should just defer our time to a more genteel bigot and hate monger. You know, Mr. Rogers.
Boys are boys from the beginning. Mm-hmm. Girls are girls right from the start. Everybody's fancy. Everybody's fine. Your body's fancy, and so is mine. Only girls can be the mummies. Only boys can grow up and be the daddies. Yes, sir, everybody's fancy. Everybody's fine. Your body's fancy, and so is mine. I think you're a special person. And I like your ins and outsides. Everybody's fancy, everybody's fine. Your body's fancy, and so is mine.
Have you ever heard such hate?
Brilliant, Dan. Brilliant.
Have you ever heard such such bigotry?
Dripping with hatred.
Tom Hanks should be canceled for playing this hate-mongering bigot, Fred Rogers, in the film, don't you think?
I haven't seen it. Does he play him this way? Does he have this speech?
Well, yeah, I don't recall this jingle, but
right.
Fred Rogers was a decent man who would be characterized by Frank Figliuzzi and Sarah Kate Ellis and Ben Collins as a hate monger today.
And John Cass would have characterized him just a few years ago as a liberal.
Sam and Valpo, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, good morning, guys.
Hey,
John Cass,
neighbor,
huge fan of your work.
It's nice to be nice to be living in America, isn't it?
Yes.
Out there in Valpo, yeah.
So, if the shooter, who I didn't know identified as non-binary till this morning, if he pleads mental insanity, will the left have to eventually admit that transism is linked to mental illness, as he is a non-binary person? I mean, John Hopkins did this study 10 years ago, 15 years ago. These procedures, they just lead to unhappiness and mental breakdown in majority of cases. I'll hang up and respond. Love your show.
Thanks for the call, Sam. I mean, I don't think he's going to use non-binary status as the means to plead mental defect, but...
Dan, you're a lawyer.
I don't think it would fly anyway. I mean, it's pretty thin defense, and just think about this logically. This is why we would get into these mass shooters. What's the one thing that what's happened? Well, there isn't a one thing, because of course there are hundreds of thousands of other Americans who identify as non-binary
who don't
and
kill people.
They don't kill people, right. So that's not going to fly. Vince in St. Charles.
Good morning, guys. Happy Thanksgiving. The left, the Democrats, they're all the same. They look in the mirror and they don't look at themselves. They blame something in back of them. They never take from themselves. They always like to blame other people for their problems and the things that they cause. They take responsibility, so they blame us and everyone else around them, never themselves.
Thanks for the call. Yeah, I mean, this is blame. It's well beyond blame to demonization. I mean, what those comments you heard from the reporter and the LGBTQ advocate and the former assistant director of counter intel for the FBI, that's just straight up demonization.
Yep.
Evidence-free, fact-free demonization. Actually, it's worse than that. It's gaslighting. It's running contrary to the facts for the purposes of demonization.
And as it continues, in this and in other platforms and, I mean, other subjects, you have to wonder, what does the left really want over long term?
Power. That's what they always
yes,
want.
Yes, of course they want.
You've made the switch, and it feels so good. You switched to Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560.
Hey, business owners, is your business and money in good hands? Does your bank invest in your success? Hi, Mike Gallagher here, letting you know that when you need a relationship bank, Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. I love these guys. Not only do they have expansive industry experience, a strong financial track record, but they're also highly capitalized for strategic growth. That's so important. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. They know what it means to grow a business by designing solutions that are right for you and only you. These are real people. They're ready to help. So reach out to my friends at Signature Bank. Make the call today. 773-467-5630. 773-467-5630. Or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Your business could be Signature Bank's next success story. Go online, signaturebank.bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender. Signature Bank.
The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning on this Thanksgiving Eve. Dan and in for Amy J. this morning is John Cass. JohnCassNews.com is where you find his work. I assume his ravings about the World Cup, too. Ridiculous as
you know,
is.
You really want to go there because
no, not yet.
You don't want to be the old uncle in the corner, you know, with hair coming out of his ears, screaming about something like, well, you're being fed scotch and soda and the kids are hoping that you'll simmer down a little bit.
There was no World Cup in my home growing up, and there will be no World Cup in my home going forward. But we can't have you on the show sitting in for Amy and not get your take on the Chicago mayor's race, which you wrote about recently on the occasion of Lori Lightfoot's launching of her Lori Delivers ad campaign, which is very persuasive. To me, I'm all in for her reelection.
Yeah.
So where do you is the race sort of what the conventional wisdom purveyors of conventional wisdom say? In your opinion, it's Lori versus Chewy?
No. I think that in terms of the future of Chicago, it's going to be Lori versus Vallis. But might be Chewy versus Vallis, or might be, you know, I don't know. But if Vallis is not in the runoff, well, then it'll be my decision to move out of Chicago into Indiana would have been a good move.
Oh, I'm sorry. You moved to Indiana. You're not allowed to talk about the Chicago.
Oh, yeah. Why? Are you one of these little bike people in spandex shorts?
You can't
get upset. God, you're not family. You don't live in Chicago.
I don't know. 6 decades in Chicago and 3 decades writing about it gives you the license, sir, to write about it once you've left?
And my family having business in Chicago and serving and helping people, right?
No.
Generations
nope.
of Chicagoans survive and feed their families? Yeah.
It's like Moonlight Graham leaving the baseball field. Once you leave the baseball field, you can't go back and play baseball.
There you go.
Once you cross the corporate boundaries of Chicago, you cannot comment on Chicago. You're probably not even allowed back.
I probably shouldn't be on your show today because I had the chance to talk to Lori Lightfoot in person. Betty and I were at this great party. Tom Serafin throws a great holiday party. Now it's back after COVID, after a long absence. And I saw Vallis there. I saw a bunch of guys, political people, a lot of media people.
That's all there is.
Former colleagues that I...
That must have been... Was it a tearful reunion with former colleagues?
It was nice to see some, yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. Like Shia Kapos.
Sure.
And I'm looking at her at her story right now.
Story? Wait, is that what she writes?
Exit from the mayor's race.
If you mean by story, if you mean tales, then yeah, okay, sure.
Well, it mentions Lopez dropping out, right?
Yeah.
I don't read that. I do subscribe to the paper that offered me a free subscription or free copy of Sunday's paper, which I didn't need. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I do read Shia and the non-business business magazine occasionally.
Anti-business business.
Is that it?
Crane.
Yeah, sorry, I blew that.
Okay. So you saw Lightfoot at Butch McGuire's
no,
for
I
Serafin.
Didn't.
You didn't.
We left because I had this thing to meet you. I have to get up at 3 o'clock in the morning, you know, to get over here in time.
Well, you know, that's the penalty of moving from the fair city.
Right. Exactly.
How do you see
it, Dan?
How do you see the shape? So here's what a lot of people want to know who, you know, are interested in adult leadership in the city. And that's not anywhere near a majority, in my view. And I think there's a lot of evidence to support that. So I don't see Paul Vallis happening. But here's what people want to know. How does Paul Vallis happen? How does Paul Vallis even get to the runoff, much less defeat Lightfoot one-on-one?
You've got several candidates still in the race who are all of the left, and they're all playing on racial identity and leftist propaganda one way or the other. And then you have Vallis on the other side. Tom Tunney, who is of the left but a businessman, has dropped out of the race. Lopez, Alderman Lopez, Hispanic, gay, politically conservative with respect to cops, has dropped off the race. So the path, there's a pathway there. I was talking to many people at the Serafin party about this. There's a pathway for Vallis to make it to the runoff. Well, and once he's in the runoff.
Come on.
Pardon me?
Before we get to the runoff, I was talking to people at the Serafin party. The Serafin party. I mean, that's the chattering class who shares a brain. That's a bunch of political hacks and media types. I like Tom, too, but I mean, I've been to that party.
You have.
Let's talk turkey about who's there, you know, present company.
Betty said, are you going to hang out with the Republicans? I said, I think they hate me more than the Democrats.
What
do.
Republicans? Yeah, right. The Vichy Republicans that show up to sidle up to Democrats? Right. Please don't hurt me. please don't come after me.
That's from the Bobby Boucher movie. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, they don't know anything.
Well, the point is, let's get to the mayor's race. How does Vallis get into the runoff? Because you have, 18%, 20% of the vote that he gets to get him in the runoff? While Lightfoot fights with Chewy for the hard left Chapatista progressives, and Brendan Johnson is also pushing from the hard left, and Tony Preckwinkle, and so is, who else is out there?
Willie Wilson has a bigger base from which he starts than Paul Vallis, certainly based on the results from 4 years ago. And 51% of the ballots cast in the race 4 years ago were cast by black residents of Chicago. Mm-hmm. So that's a, you know, so
he did very well with black residents.
Well, yeah, of course.
She
yeah.
did very well with the white Karens right. of the near north side. Who scream at you when you're picking up your dog doo for not wearing a mask, right? When you're outside. I know this because I was on Montrose and Lawndale getting yelled at by some.
Well, you know, and so the public sector unions go for Chewy. And
or the other guy, Brendan Johnson.
Yeah, probably maybe. Chewy, more viable. I mean, there may be some splitting, but the public sector unions are going to back, you know, a known socialist like Chewy.
Yes.
He is in their pocket. He will stay in their pocket. There's no question about it. Yeah, Brandon Johnson is more of a firebrand than Super Mario Garcia there. But
by the way, I like that nickname.
Well, he's a dead ringer.
Super Mario Brother.
He's a dead ringer.
But
and then Lightfoot gets right. Get front like the. Mercedes Marxists on the lake.
Yeah.
And the offals in little enclaves around the rich enclaves right. around the city in Lincoln Park and so forth. And then Paul Vallis? So Paul Vallis doesn't even resonate in the 19th ward.
Paul Vallis will pick up votes on the north side, on the southwest side.
Yeah, not enough.
Well, I think he will. But if he doesn't, the city's done. It's really simple. If he's not, because the issues for the city are crime, even though they didn't want to talk about it when you were
crime's down.
Yeah, when you were running, Darren Bailey's effort, or not running it but supporting him.
Yeah,
the crime is the issue, and the other issue is schools. And if you can't get kids and parents excited about schools, you have no city.
You can't.
And so, look, it's really simple for the people of Chicago. Do you want? I mean, I like Paul Vallis. I've known him, for, 35 years. It's not that I don't like the others. And actually, I supported and liked Lori Lightfoot until she caved.
You
and
snapped out of your trance. Yeah,
until she
kidding.
Caved and supported, you know, she gave in on the riots, gave in to BLM Antifa, and turned the city over, and then tried to kiss Tony Preckwinkle's ring by endorsing Kim Fox, her state's attorney.
Well, she gave in to the teachers union first.
Yes.
As they all do several times. Yeah, as they all do.
The only way to deal with them is to drive them out by getting real school choice here. And what really surprises me about the race for mayor is that these positions, that I know to be legitimate and important for the people of the city are not the point of the spear media-wise, even for conservative media. I don't see the Wall Street Journal in here and Fox News in here interviewing Vallis.
No, because they don't think it's they don't think he's viable because nobody's talking it up. There's no excitement about Vallis. Look, I mean, I'll say publicly what I say privately. Paul Vallis is the only adult in the race. I agree. I mean, Willie Wilson's an
I like
adult.
Willie too.
So, I mean, I genuinely like him on a personal level. But yeah. I mean, but Paul Vallis is clearly the most capable person in the race. It's not even close. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And he's right. He's the most thoughtful guy. He's got the broadest amount of experience. He overplays how successful his tenure was at CPS, which is super annoying to me. But that notwithstanding, he did great work in Philly. He did great work in New Orleans and schools.
Chile, yeah.
He's got terrible political instincts, and he doesn't listen to anybody, which is
typical
why,
Greek, right?
Which is why he continues to lose. And frankly, although I know he won't identify this now, especially typical Republican in Illinois, they don't listen either. Everybody knows everything.
He's a Democrat,
which is why they're in the super minority. But there's no enthusiasm. And then the question about money. Now I know he's raising more money than he did in the past.
Yeah.
But you don't generate the enthusiasm because nobody believes he can come over the top of the field with money, given the institutional support that Lightfoot is going to have from grifters and identitarian ideologues like Laura Ricketts.
It's simple they can have whatever they want. If they don't elect this guy, they're done. The
city's
done.
I know, but I hear what you're saying. But the point is to say, you know, what is a discernible path from here to there? And so this is not like, if not Paul, then things are going to get worse. No kidding.
Yeah.
Of course that's true. And frankly, even with Paul in the short term, depending on what he could get done, things are going to get worse because you can't just stop the inertia going downhill
right. Immediately.
But this is a political question. If you want to win and if you want to get people excited about the race, they have to believe you can win. And nobody believes he can win, which is why they're not excited about the race, which is why he's not going to win. And I don't see him charting a different course other than raising a few more shekels than he did 4 years ago that changes that perception of him as a candidate and his possibilities and the possibilities for his campaign. That's the issue.
Well, I wish it were that simple, and it's not. And you're correct that he's got to generate some enthusiasm. Part of that is now he's got money to hire people.
Yeah, he hired
that.
Joe Trippi to be his campaign manager.
Yeah.
Big deal.
Maybe Chip Trippi's not the genius, but you have to have people around who are promoting that idea, the idea that the city is dead without Paul Vallis. And I don't know how you do that while satisfying media, which will pounce on anything that resembles slightly the Bernie Epton before it's too late.
But this is the problem. This is actually one of the problems. He thinks the media, I mean, I've seen this over and over again. I've seen this with Jack Ryan. Mm-hmm. I've seen this with I know these people. They're my friends. Oh, yeah. Oh, really? I know a lot of them, too, and I get along with them or did for years until I realize just what jackals they are
right. And
how dishonest, how just fundamentally dishonest so many of them are, particularly if it ever comes to their integrity versus their acceptance within the hordes. So I've seen it over and over again. They're not your friends, and they're not going to treat you fairly because you're not their candidate. And if you don't understand that, you understand nothing. And you also don't understand how to get from here to where you want to go because they are not the conduit to get from point A to point B. They're what you leverage to get from point A to point B. In other words, Paul Vallis needs to be bold. And that's the one thing Vallis isn't. He's a policy wonk who campaigns like a policy wonk. And he wants to, I don't want to, and this and that. And he's, you know, he tiptoes around and he needs to take these good ideas that he has and the good record that he's amassed and be bold. Be like, we are going to shake this thing up. This is not working for most Chicagoans, and I'm the guy for most Chicagoans.
You want exhortations, right? I understand
well,
that.
It's not just volume, it's attitude.
Well, the attitude is he's the only candidate, and I'm at a loss to be on, you know, his defender, but he's the only candidate out there who's talking about real school choice.
I know, but
that's
a
national issue.
But I want
to see Tim. Why isn't Tim Scott here?
Well, right, because you need to illustrate it creatively. You need to. I mean, you're right. I mean, it's shameful. I mean, we have dioceses that aren't talking about the tax credit opportunity scholarship. I mean, it's terrible.
You are really the Catholic bishop of Chicago.
Well,
you know that.
Because the
current occupant doesn't do that job.
No, and by the way, in the suburbs too.
Yeah.
The Joliet Diocese in which I grew up.
Yeah.
I mean, it is shameful.
Yeah.
Just as a quick tangent, the absence of the bishop Hicks and Boyle, the superintendent of schools, who's now been relieved of duty or whatever. Good, terrible. They've done nothing. You have one priest. I'm not going to get too deep in Louisa. You have one priest out in the Joliet Diocese who's raised like about $5 million in tax credit scholarship money to try to keep these schools afloat and bring in more families who would choose a private Catholic school education if they could have some resource support. And they do. But the diocese is doing nothing. The bishop is doing nothing. The Catholic Church in Chicagoland is awful, awful. All of these institutions have cratered. And Paul Vallis, to me, is in a position to say these institutions are cratering. All the things that are the building blocks of a civil, stable, prosperous society, they're all disintegrating. And I'm the guy who builds institutions. I'm the guy who, through a collaborative effort, builds institutions that provide the foundation for widespread stability and success to end the chaos and the crime and the hopelessness and the joblessness. You need to build these institutions. It's not sexy what I do, but it's what I do, and that's what's going to work for you, and it's the only thing. And if he spoke with moral clarity, maybe not the words I use, but if he spoke with moral clarity and some passion rather than, you know, an abstract from a 20-page white paper,
yeah,
then maybe you could say this guy is going to kick some ass. But nobody looks at Paul Vallis right now and says he is going to kick some ass.
Well, then you don't have a city.
Then you don't.
City dies.
You
and,
don't.
It is devoured by the Morlocks of the left.
Well, you might as well support Lori Lightfoot. I'm only half kidding. Go get there faster. It's not bad enough. People aren't hurt enough, and the people who are hurt aren't sensible enough to help lead the revolt, or frankly, to be at the tip of the spear leading the revolt.
That's
in Chicago and the entire state. So make it worse. Go ahead.
They will scream and say, "Why didn't you tell us?"
Yeah, right.
Right. They'll scream to you. They'll call in the station and say, "You know, after January 1st, if the courts don't stop this ridiculous nonsense of Safety Act," they'll scream, "Dan Proft, why didn't you tell us?"
Greg, Jefferson Park.
Hey, good morning, Dan. Good morning, John.
Hey.
You know, John, Dan is right on this. I got to say, I went to that 4 years ago, Dan, when I met you at that debate we had out here in the Northwest Side. And, you know, a friend of mine was helping out Paul Vallis back then. And, you know, he introduced me to him, and I asked him a few questions just one-on-one. And the guy lied to me. And I told my buddy afterwards, I says, you know, how do you want you want me to vote for this guy?
He lied to you? You're calling? You this is like Twitter. You're an anonymous guy, and you're making an accusation.
Greg in Jefferson Park. He's not anonymous.
I'll tell you what, John. You know what? Go find when Paul Vallis was on with Amy one day, and I called up, and we were talking about Chicago Police Department and guns, and he said a lie then, too. Okay? You guys got it on record.
Which is what?
What do you mean?
What was the lie?
Well, it was something about how policemen have to, I don't know, it was either buy their own holsters or buy their own armored vests.
Yeah.
Okay.
Is
well,
that
and
not
then,
true?
But what's your problem with Vallis is that you don't think he's honest
enough?
He just,
he says whatever is fine at the time. You know, it's just as you said, Dan. He doesn't take a stable, strict position and say, this is what I'm going to do. This is what we need to do to clean this stuff up and get on with it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, mm-hmm. it never ends with that guy. I mean, he gets on the show, and like you said, he talks about all his policy stuff and things that he's done, and it's like, okay, yeah, that's a good thing. You need to come out and say, this is what I'm going to do, whether it be schools, police, what have you. Here's the budget. Here's how I'm going to do it, and then we're going to get on with it. You know, I mean, it's one of the reasons I think the Republicans didn't kick some in this past election is because they constantly talk about, you know, crime, the Democrats, the January 6th, all this other stuff. It's like, well, what are you going to do? What are you going to do to fix some of these problems? If you don't come out with specific answers to issues related to what the hell is going on in this city, you know, I don't think the guy's got a chance. You know, I voted for Willie last time. That's who I'm going for now. I'll vote for Vallis if he is lucky enough to get in a runoff, but I just don't see it happening. I really don't.
Thanks, Greg. Justin, New Lenox.
Hey, how's it going? Hey, my buddy works for CPD. He's paid for his vest, his gun, his holster, and all his uniforms before he even started. So they do buy all that stuff.
Okay, thanks for the call, Justin. I mean, that's all worked out in the CBAs, and I don't know the particular of the collective bargaining agreement between FOP and the current one that's enforced between FOP and the city, so I'll defer to Justin on that. But, you know, the larger issue on Vallis is just the, you know, is stylistic. It's not that he's not a substantive guy, but you have to be stylistically compelling, too. And that's what he needs to figure out between now and February 28th.
You've made the switch, and it feels so good. You've switched to Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan, and in for Amy J. This morning is John Cass, johncassnews.com, for his columns, the Chicago Way podcast. Wonderful stocking stuffer, a subscription to johncassnews.com, John.
Thanks, Dan. Of course it is. Give yourself the gift of common sense.
There you go. You know, I mentioned at the outset of the show this emotional support line from Oatly for plant eaters on this Thanksgiving holiday. And I don't think that I brought it to life. So we actually went and pulled some clips from the actual hotline just to prove it exists. They're not manufacturing the news here like the D.C. press corps. Take a listen.
Press one to hear some positive affirmations and personal validations about attending a meat and dairy-based Thanksgiving dinner. Press two to hear some useful stats and non-threatening talking points that explain how your plant-based diet reduces your climate impact. Press three to record up to 30 seconds of unrestrained venting about how frustrating it is to constantly repeat what you do and don't eat to friends and family.
And if you prefer in its traditional Swedish.
Tryck 1 för bekräftande affirmationer och uppmuntringar för att du ska gå på en kött- och mjölkbaserad taxihälsodagsmiddag.
Uh-huh. You know, because it's English or Swedish. Uh-huh.
You lost me at the meatballs.
Do you want to hear, I can't remember what number it is, press, I think it was press 4 for a motivational speech a la from the film Rudy.
Oh.
You want to hear what that sounds
yeah,
like?
Sure.
Would you prefer English or Swedish?
English, please.
All right.
You know what you need to do. Remember, no one, and I mean no one, invites us into their house for Thanksgiving and disrespects us, ignores our plant-based diet, forgets that we don't do dairy, asks what we eat and don't eat for the 37th time. They think they can get away with offering just a bowl of cranberry sauce and green bean casserole. Not gonna happen. This is your dinner, gentlemen, or gentlewoman,
yeah.
Or gentleperson.
Yeah.
Non-binary vegans.
Yeah. The funny thing is the gentlewoman, gentleperson, those are actual locker room talks today. Those are actual motivational speeches, but not about Thanksgiving dinner. Yeah. For more on this, pleased to be joined by Melanie Kirkpatrick, former Wall Street Journal opinion editor, senior fellow at the Hudson Institute, author of Thanksgiving, The Holiday at the Heart of the American Experience, and lady editor Sarah Josepha Hale and The Making of the Modern American Woman. Melanie Kirkpatrick, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Good morning, gentlemen. I've been listening to your talk about plant-based Thanksgiving dinners, and that's nothing new. It goes back to 1835 when a doctor and writer from New England dismissed Thanksgiving as a grand New England carnival and told people they should not eat so much.
Did he do that in English or Swedish?
He did it in English.
Melanie, you had me. Yeah. You had me when I read the word, in quotes, editress.
Yes.
In your piece, giving thanks for Sarah Josepha Hale and editress. I just loved it.
Well, you know, Sarah Hale, who was the godmother of Thanksgiving, that is, of our national Thanksgiving Day, she was editor of Godey's Ladies' Book, the most popular magazine of the period, and the pre-Civil War period. And she liked ESS words for defining women. She thought it made us special, and so she liked the word doctress, even teacheress. So I, as a former lady editress myself, I liked it too.
What would she think of Oatley's hotline? Is that what she had in mind when she was petitioning the president to make Thanksgiving a national holiday?
No, she had something a little more important in mind. It was in the lead up to the Civil War, and Hale believed that if the country could come together on the same day and give thanks, that maybe war would be avoided. Of course, that didn't happen, but in the middle of the Civil War, Lincoln proclaimed the first in what is now an unbroken series of National Thanksgiving Days.
Go ahead.
Go ahead. Sorry.
No, I just wanted sort of more context on Sarah Hale, because this is an important figure in the history of our country that maybe is underappreciated. I think you argue she is very underappreciated.
Yeah, I wrote the book because I wanted more people to know about her. I think she was one of the most influential women in our history, and I'd even go so far to say maybe she was the most important. She was editor of Godey's Ladies' Book for 50 years. Starting in 1828, every issue of her magazine would have articles about education for women. In 1828, there were no institutes of higher education for women, and only half of American women were even literate. So she believed that women needed to be educated, in part so that they could teach their children, but also because she thought this new nation needed educated, well-informed citizens. So Thanksgiving was another one of her campaigns, and she also thought, again, starting in 1828 and up until 1877 when she retired, she also thought that while the country had been unified politically through the Revolution, it was not unified culturally. So she set out in her magazines to help create a common American culture. That included literature, and she would publish and even discover such authors as Edgar Allan Poe and Nathaniel Hawthorne. But it also included more mundane things like food. She was the first editor to publish recipes, and she had a recipe section in her magazine. And again, the idea was that she was helping to educate American women in how to cook American-grown foods. And so there was because her magazine circulated nationwide, it was one of the first magazines to do so, all women, many women in America were reading it and learning from it. And also, she also touched on such issues as health and work for women. She thought that women should have the ability to take care of themselves and their families, especially if they became widows. So she encouraged women's entry into fields that were typically reserved for men.
As I'm putting together my own Thanksgiving Day piece, and I'm so glad to be able to talk to you, because on the issue of recipes and her attitude toward recipes, what did she have to say about the scourge of the American Thanksgiving table, which is Jell-O with with fruit chunks floating in it?
Yeah,
especially
well,
the fruit chunks.
You know, if she had lived 100 years later till the 1950s, she might have had something to say. But no, she was more into turkeys and chicken pie was a feature, a standard feature of Thanksgiving meals in the early 19th century. And she was also very keen on pies. She published many recipes for pies.
And that was before the rage of deep frying the turkeys, too. And
setting
off explosions, yes, right?
But I'll tell you, she grew up on a farm, and she believed in using every part of the animals that they butchered. So you can find recipes for parts of the animals you would never even dream of eating.
Okay. I wanted to get a little bit more explanation on why you describe Thanksgiving as the holiday that's at the center of the American experience.
Yes.
Well, you know, there's a little-known history to the holiday. We just think pilgrims and Indians, usually, but there's much more to it. There are Thanksgiving days that predated the pilgrims' arrival in America, and then there are many other aspects. The holiday is deeply connected with other parts of our history. I mentioned Abraham Lincoln, who called the first in the modern series of Thanksgiving days. And there's football, an American sport, becoming associated with the holiday. And, of course, there's the culinary history of the holiday. And then and I have chapters on each of these topics. And then this was new it was only when I was writing the book that I decided to do a chapter on Thanksgiving charity. If, you know, Thanksgiving in our history, dating the first example I found of Thanksgiving charity was in the 1630s. And Americans have always, on Thanksgiving Day, remembered the needy. And, you know, if there's a sadder image in American culture, I can't think of it. It's of, you know, somebody who has nowhere to go on Thanksgiving Day. We always think of the needy or the lonely or the poor or the sick on the holiday. And much of way we help them is on a private basis. Religious organizations, community organizations, individuals. It's not government. It's bottom-up, not top-down.
She is Melanie Kirkpatrick, former Wall Street Journal opinion editor, senior fellow at the Hudson Institute, author of Thanksgiving, the Holiday at the Heart of the American Experience, and lady editor Sarah Josepha Hale and the
editress.
Making of editress and the Making of the Modern American Woman, lady editor and Thanksgiving, the Holiday at the Heart of the American Experience, the two books from Melanie Kirkpatrick. Thanks so much for joining us. We appreciate it. Happy Thanksgiving to you and your family.
Thank you. Happy Thanksgiving to you and everybody in Chicago there.
Happy Thanksgiving.
She joined us on the Turnkey.pro answer line.
You've made the switch, and it feels so good. You've switched to Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and in for Amy J. This morning is John Cass, johncassnews.com.
Hey, Danny. Good morning.
John, I don't know how to tell you this, but we may be nearing the end of Tony Fauci's long farewell. He was gracious enough to descend from on high and join KJP, Karine Jean-Pierre, the quadruple threat, at the White House press briefing yesterday.
What do you think of your Fauci now?
He had some final words of wisdom. Mm-hmm. Those of you wearing masks.
So what do you say about the word mask now being a pejorative in some communities?
No, it shouldn't be. I mean, you're absolutely right. I mean, I know sometimes when you walk in and you have a mask and nobody has a mask, you kind of feel guilty. You shouldn't feel guilty. You look terrific.
You look terrific with that mask on. Yeah, you know what? Please do cover your face. It's funny because I actually agree with him with respect to the COVIDians. Please do cover your face. Please wear the mask, not only because you're likely as ugly on the outside as you are on the inside, but also so that we know who you are. I like the identifier, the scarlet mask, as it were.
Or use a piece of turkey skin for your mask. I mean, it's just as effective.
Now, Tony Fauci
cooking
may be,
first. Yeah.
Of course, sure, safety first. Right. Tony Fauci may be leaving us, but that doesn't mean his policies won't live on. Did you catch this? A new report from the Department of Health and Human Services says social distancing and masking should be encouraged or even mandated due to the possibility of people suffering from long COVID. Quote, the lifting of mask mandates and indifferent attitude toward masking and social distancing, typical in many public and private places, further isolates people with long COVID. As a result, policymakers should encourage or mandate policies and protocols regarding masking and social distancing in public spaces. Let's bring the mask mandate back so that we're empathetic to people with allegedly suffering from long COVID. What do you think? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636-DA, turnkey.pro text line.
Isn't that the boot on the face forever theory?
What are they?
We'll keep our government boot on your face forever.
It's what they think they can get away with, isn't it?
Right.
Tony Fauci had an additional comment on his Fare Thee Well appearance. Final words? A final thought, Springer style, Tony Fauci?
So we know it's safe. We know that it is effective. So my message and my final message, maybe the final message I give you from this podium, is that please, for your own safety, for that of your family, get your updated COVID-19 shot as soon as you're eligible to protect yourself, your family, and your community.
A perfect Fare Thee Well from one Tony Fauci. And then he engraved his name. Fauci was here on the wall of the press briefing room there at the White House.
It'll be engraved on our foreheads for every dollar that Pfizer makes. It should be a Fauci face.
I'll reserve my time and defer to our good friend Ice Cube to react to to Tony Fauci.
Yeah.
Been an Ice Cube fan since his days at NWA, before he became some sort of, you know, vanilla sitcom star and cheeseball movie, family movie star.
And law enforcement supporter.
Yeah. Right? Well, and also he, you know, the Black American Bill of Rights thing that he's been contract with Black America thing that he's been banding about since the last election cycle to present. And he's actually a lot more intelligent than most of your self-styled Black civil rights leaders who just genuflect before the big government class and the Democrat socialists. He wants the Black vote to be in play for both parties, so Black Americans have a better chance to get more benefits from the policies that are made, which is exactly, he's exactly right about that. He had this to say in a podcast recently. I turned down a movie because I didn't want to get the mother effing jab. I turned down $9 million. I didn't want to get the jab. Frack that jab. Frack y'all for trying to make me get it. I don't know how Hollywood feels about me right now. These MFers didn't give it to me because I wouldn't get the shot. I didn't turn it down. They just wouldn't give it to me. The COVID shot, the jab, I didn't need it. I didn't catch that stuff at all. Nothing. Frack them. I don't need that stuff. That's what I call a response. I'm going to appoint Ice Cube as my personal COVID spokesman, but I can't afford him. What do you think?
One of the few black personalities of, I guess, the center or left that has read Malcolm X and understood it. Right.
He's exactly right. He's not a dumb guy. 312-642-5600 turnkey.proanswerline 64636DA turnkey.pro text line. And in addition to Tony Fauci, you had Tony Fauci 2.0 on the stage. And it's just amazing. It's like when you announce for public office, you lose 40 IQ points right off the top. When I ran for office, I could afford to lose 40 IQ points. Most people cannot. Ashish Jha, who is the dean of medical school at Brown and was like a reasonable public health professional before he became Tony Fauci 2.0, standing at the podium in the press room at the White House and addressing these issues. He came out and said this is completely without evidentiary backup, because there is no evidence to back this statement up. Take a listen.
An important part of the conversation we have in the days and weeks ahead. Because here's what we know. If folks get their updated vaccines and they get treated, they have a breakthrough infection, we can prevent essentially every COVID death in America. That is a remarkable fact 2.5 years after we found this virus first in our country. But it's going to take all of us to make that happen. So please, don't wait. Get your COVID shot. Get your flu shot. That's why God gave you two arms. You can one in each arm if you want. Go to vaccines.gov.
Jesus Christ.
Honestly.
This guy.
There's no, we're going to zero COVID deaths if you just do what we say, get your jabs and continue to get that. There's no evidence to support that.
You know,
zero.
Besides the fact that these people are like chickens with their heads cut off, they are doing incalculable harm to future victims of viruses who need to be able to, understand, and get messages and get message from the government and understand things and make decisions. Because now, after all they've done, whatever the government says to me about viruses, okay, fine. I'm done with you. I'm not listening. Here's the mutza.
These wild statements. And it's Fauci 2.0 because he, as Scott Atlas, who we'll get to in a moment, points out, Tony Fauci never goes through data. Never talks in detail about the science. He just makes proclamations, just like Jha. He makes these evidence-free, fact-free proclamations about what will happen if you comply. And when those proclamations turn out to be inaccurate, he says, we're always learning. Then he goes back and parses the things, or tries to parse the things he said previously, or he just said, based on knowledge at the time, or some sort of wash away for things that he has said that turned out to be 180 degrees from reality. It's just that he's unrepentant, and the press corps is uninterested in holding people to account for what they say, the consequences attended to what they say, and whether what they said turned out to be in fact accurate or not. It's just remarkable to listen to these guys and them to continue. They are completely uninhibited by the results of their policy choices, the impact over the last 3 years, completely uninhibited. It is stay the course, 1,000 points of light, full speed ahead. Amazing.
This is the party that opposes fascism and authoritarianism.
Yeah, right.
But it's the same party that promotes it with this kind of hysterical display.
Well, and you just now, to repeat, we're on this topic on this show. We're just now getting Moderna and Pfizer to do clinical trials to study the incidence of myocarditis
yes.
in the vaccinated. Just now. And we have all of these, you know, sudden deaths.
Of that, athletes, yes, top athletes.
Top athletes and not just top athletes.
Kids, yeah.
Not just kids. I'm going to talk about this story in a second, but I know it's anecdotal. And the story we're going to tell, that's an anecdote. But the point is to say, what is the incidence? And is there a correlation or even worse, causation? And what are we, if anything, to take from? You can't ask those questions. Then you're a COVID, you're a vaccine denier, you're anti-vax, you're this, you're that, all the hysterias. How do you not question incidents like what happened this past Saturday? At 7:59 p.m. on Saturday, November 19th, Captain Patrick Ford collapsed at the controls of his American Eagle only seconds after the 76C jet had left the runway in Chicago. Ford was speaking to an air traffic controller at O'Hare when his voice abruptly stopped. "Can I help you?" the controller asked. "We need to return. Captain is incapacitated," said Ford's co-pilot. The jet bound for Columbus, Ohio, barely 2,000 feet of altitude. Any mistake would have led to a crash. But the co-pilot, Captain Brandon Hendrickson, took control. Hendrickson brought the jet to 5,000 feet within minutes, had it back on the ground at O'Hare. And so this guy, Hendrickson, did a great job, as you would expect from a professional pilot, but it was a great job, stayed cool. For the captain, Ford, his body remained in the pilot seat throughout. He was out, and the American Eagle just said that a crew member had become ill shortly after departure, passed away at the hospital. And we know that most pilots flying today got the jab because it was a condition of their ongoing employment. So, again, we don't know the particulars. Could have been completely unrelated to the vaccine. We don't know. But questions that are being asked about anomalous incidents like this are just dismissed out of hand. Like, you can't even ask the question. No, you can ask the question. Give me the answer. If the answer is it had nothing to do with COVID and here's the autopsy and so on and so forth, right. Fine. But
again, the same party that screams about authoritarianism and fascism are the same people who won't let you even ask a simple question about something like this.
Right. And American declined to disclose if Ford had been vaccinated or boosted. Pilots and American have also noted a sharp increase in disability filings since last summer, although no one has yet directly connected those to the mRNA shots. So we're not making connections that aren't there. We're asking. And, you know, if this was not additive with all of the other anecdotes
right. That
we were just mentioning,
right. Generally
speaking, of the young and athletes. One of the poster children for the shot, a four-year-old in South America that died suddenly. If we didn't have these questions and we were getting answers that address the questions, I mean, if we didn't have these incidents, and to the extent we did, we were asking questions and we were getting answers to the questions, then it'd be a different story. But you're not allowed to ask the questions, and if you do, you're not getting any answer. You're just being ridiculed.
And what is the financial relationship, if any, or future financial relationship, if any, between the big pharma and people like Fauci and people in Fauci's position? Is there any?
Well, I mean, this to me is one of the things that the House Republican majority needs to take up and perhaps propose new administrative rules for what is and is not permissible for public health officials at FDA and CDC as it pertains to their professional responsibilities so that they're not potentially as susceptible to agency capture from big pharma as one would argue they are now. That's a huge topic area, and it should be raised and investigated and discussed at the congressional level. And of course, the only place you're going to have at least the potential for progress is with committees that are chaired by Republicans in the House. Scott Atlas, Dr. Scott Atlas, one of the few that was willing to challenge Fauci publicly from a perch in the White House when he was finally brought on by President Trump to expand the professional council from public health professionals within the COVID response under President Trump. Atlas was on with Laura Ingraham last night. He said this about Fauci's fare thee well.
I think we should talk about Dr. Fauci's legacy, if I have a minute, because he's got a very important legacy. Number one, he presided over the biggest failure in public health history over two different presidential administrations. Number two, his policies were implemented, and those policies shifted the burden of this illness from the affluent to the poor and incurred massive harm on our children, psychological damage, long-lasting damage, an obesity crisis, and we really haven't seen the tip of the iceberg on that damage to children, and again, worse on low-income and poor kids. And then thirdly, and perhaps most importantly, Dr. Fauci, Dr. Birx, his underling, and many of these other people at the CDC and on the talking heads on TV have destroyed the trust in public health. We have a huge challenge as a country to fix what happened in his wake.
Well, and that's exactly what you were just talking about, that last piece, John, yeah, about the trust, the legitimacy of public health professionals.
The pain that they've caused America, the destruction of the relationship between children and learning, the isolation of children at school or from school, is incalculable. And it will be visited in practical terms upon the people of Chicago, because the government caved to the teachers union and locks people out of schools, when the crime stats from today's 10-year-olds or 12-year-olds switch to, you know, dealing with them as adults or 17 or 18-year-olds. And then you'll see it.
Lee and Hammond, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Yeah, guys. You know, the only thing you got to remember about the legacy of Tony Fauci is he promoted the idea of gain-of-function research on pathogens to make them more lethal. Mm-hmm. His NIH helped fund the research at Wuhan. Wuhan was the epicenter of this pandemic. And when all this came to light, he gave no input as to what his role was in all this. To this day, he's clammed up about this whole thing, has nothing to say about it, and he's been protected by the media in this country. That's that's the only thing you have to know about this guy. And the idea that they can get away with this kind of thing in our society is actually the most shocking part of this whole thing.
Thanks for the call, Lee. It's not the only thing, but it's one of the things. By the way, there was an attempt to question him about COVID origins, and that was shouted down by Karine Jean-Pierre, the press secretary, quieting up the press. No questions about gain of function.
Point of privilege?
I mean, origins and much less gain of function. And by the way, that's one of the great tragedies of Republicans failing to take the Senate on November 8th, is because now you won't have Rand Paul or Ron Johnson in a position to be the committee chairman to do the kind of to drive the kind of reckoning on the Senate side that they would have driven with Fauci. You're going to have to rely on, you know, the Jim Jordans of the world on the House side, which he's more than capable of. And Fauci was asked about that, and he said, of course, he'll comply with any House committee request for him to appear and testify. We'll see.
Wasn't it Biden who promised us we'd find out about the origins of COVID within, you know, the Wuhan lab or the wet market?
Yeah.
Wasn't there a 90-day, date?
There was, and they issued a report about 90 days later saying, we don't know.
So it's kind of like the motive for the Las Vegas shooter, right? That it was mowed down, I don't know how many people.
We did a report. 60. It's unknowable, so let's just move on. That's essentially the position of the White House and of the COVIDian left. Of course it is. You know, these great searchers of truth, these great devotees of science and data, always interested in learning and advancing through knowledge, the human condition. What a bunch of nonsense.
Oy.
What a bunch of nonsense. And I mean, Tony Fauci, but that's not the only thing. I mean, Tony Fauci, to your point, John, about kids,
right,
and his Gretchen Whitmer routine is part of his long farewell. Shut down the schools. I didn't shut down any schools. I just, you know, I'm just a guy who provides advice and counsel. You know, I'm just some pointy head over at CDC. Yeah, right.
Αυτός μιλάει και ο γάιδρος κλάνει.
Translate.
He speaks and the donkey breaks wind.
John Cass in for Amy J on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Connect with Dan and Amy using the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Top of the morning, Dan, and in for Amy J this morning is John Cass, johncassnews.com. You know, this old Michael Moore riff on Donald Trump is remaking the rounds. I don't know, given, you know, as the dust settles from November 8th and you're going to pick up the race to 2024 in earnest here, with Trump already announcing, of course, maybe it's time to revisit this in terms of framing. Michael Moore, now, his riff on Donald Trump in advance of the 2016 election that the Trump-Pence team turned into a campaign commercial.
I know a lot of people in Michigan that are planning to vote for Trump, and they're not, they don't necessarily like him that much, and they don't necessarily agree with him. They're not racist and rednecks, and they're actually pretty decent people. And so I wanted to sort of, after talking to a number of them, I wanted to write this. And Donald Trump came to the Detroit Economic Club and stood there in front of the Ford Motor executives and said, if you close these factories as you're planning to do in Detroit and build them in Mexico, I'm going to put a 35% tariff on those cars when you send them back, and nobody's going to buy them. It was an amazing thing to see. No politician, Republican or Democrat, had ever said anything like that to these executives. And it was music to the ears of people in Michigan and Ohio and Pennsylvania and Wisconsin, the Brexit states. You live here in Ohio, you know what I'm talking about. Whether Trump means it or not is kind of irrelevant, because he's saying the things to people who are hurting. And it's why every beaten down, nameless, forgotten working stiff who used to be part of what was called the middle class loves Trump. He is the human Molotov cocktail that they've been waiting for. The human hand grenade that they can legally throw into the system that stole their lives from them. Trump's election is going to be the biggest f*** you ever recorded in human history. And it will feel good.
Wow.
That's what it was. Michael Moore saw it. I mean, as much of a left-wing crank as he is, he at least is aware enough of people's attitudes and the, you know, not everybody lives on Torch Lake or used to live there, right, up in Michigan, the ritzy area. But he gets the feeling in the Rust Belt. He got the feeling in advance of 2016, and he was right. So are things going to be that much different going forward the next 2 years in 2024? I mean, I know, you know, mortgage rates have dropped to 6.6%, and this is being heralded just the way that inflation ticking down a bit this month, or last month, I should say, has been heralded, and the market, you know, rebounding a bit. So happy days are here again, but I don't think they are.
Economics works. I don't think so.
Yeah, I don't think that's sustainable over the next 2 years, because it's not sustainable economic policies if you want to produce growth and provide opportunity. So, you know, despite all of the histrionics and the internal dissension, and Trump's legal problems and his rhetorical problems, I wonder how much different those same voters in the Rust Belt will feel about where the country is in 2024 versus how they felt about it in 2016.
There's a sullenness that's falling upon the American people, particularly those who may be predisposed to vote for Trump or vote Republican. And a friend of mine who writes for John Cass News has suggested, Michael Ledwith has suggested, it's almost like a point in A Tale of Two Cities when the coach, driven by for a nobleman, runs over a little girl and kills her. And the coachman sticks his hand out of the cab of the coach and throws a few coppers in the street as recompense.
For more on this, pleased to be joined by Steve Moore, economist, author of Govzilla. Steve, thanks for joining us as always. Happy Thanksgiving.
Hey, guys. Good morning. By the way, the Moore family has figured out a way to combat the higher inflation for the Thanksgiving dinner. We bought a little bit of a smaller turkey this year.
There you go.
Yeah,
there you go. Well, what about, you know, where things are? I mean, again, this sort of positive economic news against the backdrop of terrible economic conditions, whether that is really indicative of a new direction, a new prosperity that we'll enjoy in the new year or not, and how that sort of impacts where we are going into the next election cycle as compared to where we were going into 2016, not this last one.
So a couple of things. First of all, I'd never heard that Michael Moore video. Was it a video or audio tape that you were
speech,
playing?
Speech, and they turned it into a commercial.
I never had seen that. I mean, look, Michael Moore, I've debated Michael Moore, by the way. We've done the Moore versus Moore debate. Mm. And in some ways, do I think Michael Moore is right on policy? No. I disagree with almost all his policy things. But at least he's a kind of honest, old-fashioned liberal who cared about the middle class and cared about, you know, working-class people. The Democratic Party does not care about working-class people anymore. They obsess about things like, you know, climate change, and not what, you know, putting food on the table for people who matter and who build things in this country. And so, you know, it's so infuriating to me. Who is the base of the Democratic Party today? It's rich white liberals. They're the ones who fund the party because they're so rich. It doesn't matter to them if the economy collapses because they have so much money and they can feel good about themselves. But the fact is that if you look at what happened, for example, in the 2016 and 2020 election, it was basically, you know, the lowest income districts of the country voted against Trump, and the middle class districts of the country overwhelmingly voted for Trump in both 2016 and 2020. So this idea that somehow, you know, the Democrats are the party of the middle class is absurd. Now, you know, what's going to happen?
The question becomes, what is the Republican Party going to do to make sure those same voters come out in a way they didn't without Trump if they're without Trump again in 2024?
Well, that is the puzzle. That is the conundrum. You know, I saw Trump last week. I was out at Mar-a-Lago, and you'll be proud of me, Dan. I told him two things. First, I just said, you know, I thought his speech when he announced he's running president was excellent. It was an incredibly great message. It's like, look at what the country was like 4 years ago when I was president, when we had a secure border, when we were fighting crime, when we had the lowest poverty rate ever, when we cut taxes, reduced regulation. You know, we were energy independent. We were exporting oil and gas. And look at the world today. You liked it better 4 years ago or you liked it better today? And that's a strong, strong argument that Trump has when he runs for president is, you know, I did it. I rebuilt the American economy. He told me twice, you know, I did it when taking over from Obama. And then after COVID, we had to come back. And the question is, if Trump is not the candidate, and he may well not be the candidate, you've got a lot of people like DeSantis. A lot of the Trump money is running over to DeSantis. Can he capture that blue collar voter? I don't know the answer to that, Dan. I mean, that's the tough question to answer.
What made Trump attractive to the blue collar guys that I know was his persona, I will go and kick those guys in their special purpose.
Right.
I will kick them in their special purpose till it comes out of their mouth. And angrily repeatedly. And I don't know if DeSantis could do that.
Maybe not. You know, DeSantis has been, he did win Florida by 20%. You know, I haven't made up my own mind, by the way. So yeah. I work for Trump. I have great respect for him. I think it's a good thing to put them all on the stage. We have other good candidates, too, as Republicans. Kim Reynolds, the governor of Iowa, is fantastic. You've got, you know, so many good people. Mike, I have great respect for Mike Pence. Put them on the stage and see how they perform. Meanwhile, look at what do the Democrats have to offer?
Just I mean,
who the hell
muzzle,
they going to run for president?
Muzzle
I think
Lindsey
they may
Graham.
Want to run. Maybe they're going to run Pritzker. You know, he's done such a wonderful job in Illinois.
Exactly.
Or maybe they can run Gavin Newsom, the governor of California. He's done a great job. Oh yeah, a million people left California. I mean, they have no bench at all. But I think the most important thing right now is that how do you ask the key question, how do you get those blue collar workers who went, you know, en masse for Trump in states like Wisconsin, in states like Ohio and Michigan and Pennsylvania, how do you get them, you know, back because they voted Democratic this time around, or at least
or they didn't come out.
They didn't come out.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's the real issue.
But here's the thing about Trump. You know what people, those blue-collar workers, really loved about Trump? He figuratively stuck his middle finger out to Washington, D.C., the swamp.
Yeah.
You know, his most powerful argument at the end of that 2016 was drain the swamp. You know, people are not stupid. Americans understand that Washington is just a place that enriches itself. The more money you send to Washington, the richer Washington gets. Nobody else gets rich off of this. Four of the five wealthiest counties in America are right around where I'm sitting today, in the swamp.
As long as Mitch McConnell and Lindsey Graham speak for the Republican Party.
Yeah, that's true.
How can
I mean, I liked what Mitch McConnell has done on the judiciary and putting, you know, making sure we have good people on the bench. But maybe it is maybe time for some new leadership. I mean, my God, and I've known Mitch McConnell for years and years and years, but he's almost older than Joe Biden. You know, maybe some fresh blood might be a good thing for the Republican Party.
What's your economic forecast in the first couple of quarters of next year? What's it going to look like? Is inflation on the way back to 3% on their timeline of 2025?
Well, one thing that this past election has taught me, Dan, is humility, because I was so wrong. I mean, I did think we were going to see a red wave because we have the worst president in modern times. And I thought, you know, that people would rise up and revolt, and they didn't. And so I have become more humble in making predictions about what's going to happen. I will say this, that Biden made this case about a week ago. He was saying, oh my gosh, you know, all that massive amount of spending we authorized in the Inflation Acceleration Act and the Build Back Better bill, and all those, that money hasn't even hit the economy yet. It's going to hit the economy in 2023. He said that is like a good thing, you know, but wait a minute, if the money hasn't been spent yet, it can't cause inflation. So I'm not buying that we're out of the woods on inflation by any means. I think it's incumbent on Republicans to say, whoa, Nelly, maybe we don't need to spend that $2-3-4 trillion that you authorized. Maybe a good strategy would be to cancel that spending, especially the money on the IRS agents. That's we save $50 billion there. And by the way, they also have, Dan, did you know this? There is a $300 billion, not million, $300 billion green energy slush fund in the bill that's been authorized. You know who's running that slush fund, Dan?
John Podesta.
He's just a Democratic political hack. Where do you think that money's going to go? Do you think it's going to change the temperature of the planet? No, it's on every left-wing, you know, politician and green energy group. So there's plenty to cut, Dan.
Well,
I mean,
and also $400 billion in student loan forgiveness that's being held in abeyance and thus now pushing the forbearance for student loans off another few months.
Oh, by the way, can you imagine? Let's just imagine an alternative universe, which is that that you had a situation where Donald Trump were president and he adopted a policy that was not authorized by Congress, was turned down by the courts two or three or four times. You can't do this. And he went forward in doing it. They would call him a dictator. They would want to impeach him. You know? And Biden does it. I mean, the courts have said, no, you can't do this, Joe Biden. And he's still doing it.
Look, this is the same administration that has opened the border and basically says to the people of America, kiss my behind, okay?
Yeah.
There's no
he's
law.
Not, yeah, this he's is the no one who's law. Sticking the middle finger out.
Yeah.
But he's
people.
Sticking it out to the American people. Yeah, exactly.
There's no law here.
Steve Moore, economist and author of Govzilla. Steve, thanks for joining us. Enjoy your smaller-than-usual turkey this
smaller
year.
Smaller turkey. You know, we all have to, you know, we all have to tighten our belt, except Washington. You know, they don't have to tighten their belt.
More
but
rice, more bread.
There you go. Have a good one, guys. Take
you
care.
You too. Steve Moore, join us on the turnkey.pro answer line.
Hear about the big stories of the day, then talk about them right here on Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Sports and politics and sports and politics and sports and politics and intersection. Arrogance and ignorance, arrogance, ignorance, and arrogance and ignorance. Intersection.
Dan and John Cass, JohnCassNews.com, JohnCassNews.com for John Cass's work, columns, and the Chicago A podcast, Perfect Stocking Stuffer, JohnCassNews.com.
Dan Proft, I love you, man. Thanks so much. I take everything back about you having ear hair because you hate soccer.
No, you don't have to take that back. Yeah, no, but hey, look, we're not doing sports and politics to talk exclusively about the World Cup.
Okay.
But I did want to give you the opportunity to explain why we should pay attention to this favored sport of Leninists and Islamic theocrats.
When I was a kid in Chicago and Oak Lawn, I played baseball and football because I wanted to be an American. And my kids, we were watching Green Bay and the Bears, and they were watching it with me. But they had a computer up in the living room because we didn't let them, you know, at 11 years old, the computer came out of the bedroom downstairs in public where it belongs. And they were watching John Terry highlights. They're like, "Dad, check this out."
What is a John Terry?
John Terry was the greatest center back of his time.
What about Karl-Heinz Grenitzer?
Karl-Heinz Grenitzer was a great player for the Chicago Sting.
Oh, okay. That's the only hockey player or soccer player I know.
Yeah. But, right. Okay, so I knew then that I'd lost them to what I thought was the commie sport. You know,
and so you're admitting that was a parental failure
around Western. No, because it worked out. Sometimes parents should allow their children to explore. You know, don't force them to be conservatives by ramming Hayek down their throat at 8 years old. You know, like I want the book report, and it worked out.
Uh huh. Well, your kids are grown now. You don't have to keep up this facade. You can you can join us and properly lampoon soccer.
All right,
calisthenic.
You and I have a mutual friend. Let's say her name is Beth.
Uh-huh.
And she was talking to me yesterday, and I slept through your rant against soccer, and I said I slept through it. But I'll listen to it. And, of course, you brought it up again. And I'm just going to say, defending soccer to people who hate it this way is like trying to defend literature to Cro-Magnon men.
Interesting simile choice.
Thank
you,
sir.
That's, yeah, right. Literature to Cro-Magnon.
Literature, I'm a writer,
soccer, and right, yeah, yeah. Okay, yeah. Nice rhetorical flourish.
Thank you.
Here's the thing. It's not so much, I mean, we can spend all day explaining why soccer is a calisthenic, but the point is, what's it doing in Qatar? Comment on, you know,
ground.
Morgan Freeman's presence and corporate America's presence. And
what's Morgan Freeman doing there?
I don't know. I mean, I'm not watching it. I just know he was there. I saw
playing
the reporting.
God or a Samaritan or something.
I don't know. Yeah. You know, what about that piece of it? How comfortable are you? I mean, I guess if you're a soccer fan, you have to be comfortable with authoritarians, because that's where soccer is played. But what about that? What about these choice that FIFA made of Qatar?
I don't mind FIFA playing in Qatar. I don't mind. Look, it's a sport to me. I want to see the sport, and all these people and 5 billion fans. All right, and these kids who who are playing soccer
yeah.
and the in World Bur- Cup have
in
wanted
Burkina
to
Faso, yeah, maybe. Yeah.
Have wanted to play this in the World Cup all their lives and have dedicated their lives to the sport, and defending it again, as I say, is sort of like trying to talk about Mencken to those children who were in that movie, like that Australian dystopian movie. What is it? Mad Max? You know, where they're recalling history as they
yeah.
do, you know, with like,
all right.
you know, well, the way they speak, you know, and you're going to talk to them about Mencken or Dostoevsky, it's not going to work.
All right, let me know who, like, if it's Saudi Arabia or Uruguay who wins.
The real thing.
So I can report on that
later. The thing
next week,
I think we can.
Whenever it ends.
What we can agree on is that the American attitude of soccer, at least the American Soccer Federation, to put the rainbow flag on the American flag in Qatar is, to me, little children playing foreign policy, illiterate children playing foreign policy.
Well, they're aspiring authoritarians, and that's a very safe place to be an authoritarian. I mean, the American flag, as you know, is a symbol of hate and intolerance, and the LGBTQ plus flag is a symbol of tolerance and love and in indication that we're all God's children and so on and so forth. I mean, that's the unifying flag, which it probably should replace the American flag. Kneel yes. before the American flag and salute the LGBTQ plus flag.
But
so long as it's updated per the Microsoft model to include the colors representing all 40 genders. Although
I
now
thought it was 80 genders.
There's 97 in the San Francisco Trans Universal yeah. Basic Income Program. Right. So at least four. We'll say at least 40. You got to clear at least 40 to be a unifying.
But I thought
flag,
the left.
Unifying
I thought
symbol.
The left cared about Muslim people and their culture. No. No,
well, they did. That's why they're there.
But the left cares about them, but then rubs the rainbow flag in their face.
Well,
in other words, the American left will not allow people to have their own religion, right?
Yeah,
the religion is American leftism. That's it. I think.
Well, right, and I mean, I'm sure that you know that's just a message back to. You know, conservative cretins in this country. That's they're not trying to offend their fellow authoritarians, even though they may be coming from different places. They're trying to get to the same destination, which is the elimination of the diversity of viewpoints. So, I mean, you know, they're coming from the same place. They just right. have different paths to get there, you know?
Yeah, so they don't really mind if their hands get cut off for something because
they're on
the same team.
Right, you're going to break a few eggs. You know, on the road to...
Walter Duranty.
On the road to heaven on earth.
That's Walter Duranty talking about Stalin.
Right.
And the starvation of, what, 10 million kulaks in Ukraine? Yeah.
You know? Again, immunizing the Eskaton is messy business. You know? Ralph and Rantoul, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Yeah, good morning. Hey, the reason that Morgan Freeman is in Qatar...
Yeah.
He's doing his next meetup with Andy Dufresne, since Mexico isn't safe to hang out in anymore. And they're going to talk about why Red hung himself. And
I think it's hanged himself.
In addition, yeah, and to...
No, not Red. He was Morgan... Wait, Morgan... Let's get it.
He was
Morgan
Red.
Freeman was
Oh,
Red.
Right, yeah,
Brooks,
yeah, no.
Brooks.
Exactly.
Like Brooks, yeah. Right.
Brooks. Brooks was here, exactly.
Brooksy, yeah.
And with the little LGBTQ flag... They're going to hand them out just before they push the gays off the nearest high rooftop.
Thanks for the call, Ralph. Greg Schomburg.
Greg.
Hey, John. John, how are you?
Love Greg.
Your shoulder and your picture from Seraphim last night looks great.
Oh,
with all this Democrats.
That stuff? No hugging of Lori because I'd already booked. I was already out of there because I didn't want Dan to ridicule me mercilessly.
I got two things for you. First of all, could you imagine Dan Proft becoming a parent and having to go through soccer?
Full stop there. Just Dan Proft becoming a parent.
I would love it.
I think
it would be great.
You want to see some hands and feet get cut off.
I would like to see Dan discussing, you know, when his child becomes like a lib, you know, and the kid's going liberal, like in eighth grade or freshman
soccer
year of high school.
Soccer takes over church schedules. It takes over your life. Two kids, two practices per week, typically one, possibly two games on the weekend. And it eliminated baseball as of the third grade for my kids. And that was one of the saddest days of my life because I was the manager. Then the second thing I've got, John, is before you leave today, could you give our hero one of your turkey movies? Because Hayek has requested a turkey as opposed to Hamburger Helper this weekend.
A turkey. You have turkey movies? Thanks for the call, Greg.
Yes, I do.
Like
have
Kentucky
turkey.
Fried movie?
Turkey brining. Turkey I'm an authority. I'm the authority on cooking a turkey, for God's sake. Everybody knows this. Greg of Schomburg knows this.
I thought beer can chicken was your deal.
No, that was like so yesterday.
Oh.
Okay, we're now in rosemary like spatchcock flattened chicken. Yeah, I'm a chef, my friend. I can't deal. This again. We're so far beyond what you think cooking is because you think cooking, no offense, is opening a can of Franco's American spaghetti into a bowl.
You think I open cans? What do you think I'm some sort of barbarian? No, I go out to eat. Leave it to professionals. I am one of the leading patrons of the restaurant industry.
I have not seen the story. Was there a story about Dan Proft's like sumptuous mansion or a manse in the Lake Point Tower when you sold it?
My summer home in Minsk? What about it? Oh, yeah, there was a story about it, but they didn't catch the important part as sort of a way to live the urbane lifestyle, which was my refrigerator has had nothing in it for, I don't know, I lived there for 16 years, so that would be about 16 years.
Even the freezer had no vodka?
No.
What are you talking about?
No, I don't chill my vodka.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Well, so I wanted to get to this sports betting thing, but you
I'm Greek, okay? I don't bet
diet
on sports.
Tribe. Greeks don't bet?
Bet on sports, no.
They just play cards?
We like sports.
Is that a stereotype? Is that some sort of
when I was a little kid,
hate speech
on Peoria Street? There was one of our neighbors was a gambler,
mm-hmm.
and people came for him. And I remember him running through the house. We were in the apartment eating Franco-American spaghetti. My mom told us, the Americani, if you go to their house, you're going to eat Franco-American. And she was right. And then the man was running.
Get your knees capped. Yeah,
yeah the man was running away. They came up the back step. He got caught on the front stoop, and they curbed him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, put his mouth on the curb and kicked the back of his head, which is, I guess, improves the dental work or something. It creates a market for dentists.
And, yeah, it creates an impression that when you reach your threshold, you better pay up.
And I don't. You know, I've never bet on sports.
Huh.
The American government hooks people on this thing.
Well, this is the perfect segue.
Mm-hmm.
We'll do like a special edition of Open Mic Friday, make it Open Mic Wednesday because, you know, we're off for the holiday.
Right.
So I want to start there because the issue in the New York Times, actually did something that's somewhat worthwhile. The influence of these sports betting operations, not, you know, Vito the bookie, but the professionalized state-sponsored, state-sanctioned gambling, the predatory government that you're describing, and how it's on college campuses now. I mean, this is really interesting stuff in terms of how this insinuates itself and, again, takes from people's back pockets what the government can't extract from their front pockets.
One of our mutual friends, Steve the Pilot, as a family member who was involved in working for one of these big corporations.
Dave Portnoy? Is that a family member? all right, hold on a second. Steve in Northwest Indiana, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Yeah, two things.
Hey, neighbor.
any fish tomorrow, John?
Any fish tomorrow? That's not Christmas Eve, and I'm not Sicilian. Am I going fishing?
No. Are you going to have any fish dishes tomorrow?
There's no fish dishes.
Come on. What do you mean?
What, like lake trout? Like frozen lake trout? Like steaks or something? That's all.
Sure.
It's Thanksgiving,
Why not, my friend. Hey, look, man. It's more like a smorgasbord. You got to get a little bit of everything in there.
Got to go get the smoked Calumet Fisheries. You know,
there
since
you
I
go.
Moved out there, I can get to it easier. Yeah.
Second thing, Dan, this is the perfect season for you to give Amy the heave-ho, and since you're a cynical, Grinch, give Amy the heave-ho and bring John on full-time.
Yeah.
He can't afford me.
Thanks for the call, Steve. I'm not cynical. Oh. I think I'm a realist. Yeah. That's what I think.
You know what? The sound
unvarnished,
effects.
Unvarnished realist.
The Dan voice and the Amy voice is like something that we in the Cass household, when we're eating our poached eggs, you know, we just rely on it.
Poached eggs. Okay. All right. When we come back, it'll be Open Mic Wednesday, and we're going to start with the sports gambling because I'm adamant about it. Dan and John Cass in for Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
It's news, opinion, insight. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Open mic! Open mic Friday!
Wednesday.
Call in now! Open mic Friday!
Wednesday. Dan and John Cass in for Amy J. JohnCassNews.com. Subscribe, get his columns, get the Chicago Way podcast, perfect stocking stuffer. On this Open Mic Wednesday, of course, because we're off for the holiday and happy Thanksgiving. Taking your calls, 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, your comments, concerns, compliments, general crack pottery, we'll take it all.
Well, I'd like to make an announcement. I'm going to take advantage of the Salem Radio offer for commercials.
And, food for the poor?
Yeah, I want to donate for food for the poor, and I don't know if you guys can handle Cass commercials on WIND, but I hope they'll accept it.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah. Make that $2,500 check out to Dan Proft Enterprises. No, I'm kidding. Of course, you would like me to voice your commercial, no doubt.
I'll ask Jeff Carlin to produce it, yeah.
Okay, very good. All right, John's on board for a business benefactor program. Love it.
Yeah.
Very good. Thank you.
It's important, you know.
To
give. And it's a great advertising deal, and I need to reach people. So,
like we discussed with Melanie Kirkpatrick earlier in the show, the holidays are a time for giving, Thanksgiving, to be thankful and giving, and so
and not eating Jell-O.
Our partnership with Food for the Poor is the perfect vehicle. Great, right. Thank you, John. I did want to get to this story because I think it's interesting. You know, since the Supreme Court decision in 2018, Murphy v. NCAA, for those scoring at home. Paved the way for gambling legalization across the Fruited Plains. So what's happened? I'm not just talking about, the expansion of casinos, both in terms of size and number. We see that in Illinois. But also DraftKings and FanDuel and these other betting outfits that you see advertised during sporting events. What the gaming operators are doing and how they're co-opting state legislatures and legislators, as P.J. O'Rourke famously observed, as long as buying and selling is controlled by legislation, the first thing to be bought and sold be legislators. Well, that's what's happening with respect to gambling expansion. And it's making its presence felt in places you wouldn't necessarily think, but that are havens for betting. And look, I'm not moralizing here.
Like where?
I've been known to partake in games of chance and lay wagers on sporting events. So I'm not moralizing, but I am asking the question whether you think this is a positive development. For example, and this is, by the way, is a New York Times piece that focuses on partnerships between gambling outfits and colleges, universities. So their infestation, if you will, of college campuses. So, for example, there's a deal between a betting company called PointsBet and the University of Colorado Boulder. Each time someone downloads the PointsBet app and uses a special promo code, the university gets a $30 fee.
Whoa.
And
we could kind of work that out with bongs, too, and marijuana, right?
Well, I mean,
the same thing.
In September of last year, Michigan State University's athletic department sent an email to an online betting company. Michigan State's athletic department sent an email to the decision-making structure at the college about an online betting company that was willing to pay millions to promote gambling on campus. The offer from Caesars Sportsbook turned out to be worth $8.4 million over 5 years. LSU has a deal with Caesars, also signed last year, similar to Michigan State's. And the university sent an email encouraging some students, even who are under the age of 21, can legally gamble to place your first bet and earn your first bonus.
So when you have a concussion or injury issue, how does that play when you have an institution involved in depending, for money on the outcome of a game?
Well, these are point shaving scandals, of a bygone era from Northwestern to Tulane, the Boston College. I mean, the question here is the alignment of incentives. It's just like we argue about this in terms of how you use gambling as the means to finance core functions of government. We know this in Illinois very well. The Illinois Lottery was going to do what? Fund schools. And we were never going to have to talk about school funding again. Of course, that hasn't happened, and we've increased school funding at a 45-degree angle since the mid-'80s when the lottery came online. And then casinos, and then video poker, and then these sports betting operations. And it's always some noble purpose for the revenue the state expects to generate, although the projections of what the state generates versus what they actually generate tend to be much less than what they actually generate tends to be much less than what was projected, in part because there's all sorts of tax incentives that are built into these deals between the gambling company operators and units and these legislatures, state governments, and so it's the question sort of is like, is this a responsible way to fund government? The other question is gambling an industry that creates real wealth as opposed to other sectors, or is it sort of innately parasitic? And so do we really want to cast our lot, both in terms of funding core function of government as well as the incentives that are presented directing, sort of influencing people's behavior? Do we want the focus to be on the participation in gambling and drug use and abortions and smoking? I mean, that's why I say this is predatory addictions. Government. This is government acting against the interests of their constituents, I believe.
I agree, but there's a great Matt Damon movie a few years ago called Rounders.
Yeah, of course.
In which he's playing, and the line of the movie is, if you're in a card game and you don't know who the sucker is, then you're the sucker.
Right.
And the same thing with this, with people. The American people are played for the sucker by their own government, because the way to make money in gambling is the juice or the vig.
Just to be on the house side.
Yeah, on the house side.
Right.
Right. And, let these baby talkers talk about, the point spreads. Ultimately, the house will win.
Well, here's the thing.
Is that good if the government is the drug dealer?
Yeah, but I'm not trying to protect people from themselves either. So I want to make that clear. I'm not saying this should be illegal any more than smoking should be illegal.
God forbid.
If you want to do destructive things that are self-regarding, well, that's your business. But then don't expect society to clean it up. But spread and circuses. You want to spend your marginal entertainment dollar playing blackjack or betting on sports, and you can, you know, operate within your means. Okay, it doesn't rub me the wrong way. I don't care. But it's the whole idea behind it, that this is some solution for irresponsible government that recklessly spends money it doesn't have, or that this is job and wealth creation. And again, it's nothing against people who work in the gaming industry. I'm just saying like the idea this is the crown jewel of our economy. That, I think, is what's getting lost, because there's all the glitz and the glamour. And it's fine, entertainment venues, and you go see a nice show and you have a nice dinner and you play some cards. Fine. Nobody's saying it. Well, at least I'm not saying it should be prohibited. But it's just a question of the fanfare associated with it. Is this something that you really want to see continue to be replicated and scaled in all of its various forms? You know what I mean? I don't know. And you want partnerships with your kids' college, encouraging, you know, all the guys at the frat house to spend their weekends on these sites, betting on, you know, every kickoff on a college or pro football game.
But then the college has a star athlete with a concussion, and then they talk about concussion protocols. But miraculously, he can play in the big game against State.
There's no reason that you necessarily know, because you attend a university, you have special inside knowledge on what's happening with the football team.
But the university itself is going to be making money. Right?
But they make money. But the university is the house. It doesn't matter whether the star player plays or not. They're making their money, because all you need is the action. Right.
Yeah.
Is that really the sort of business partnership you want? Is this what's attendant to higher education now? And by the way, these partnerships and yet still the tuition goes up at, you know, 3 and 4x inflation on an annualized basis, because it's subsidized by the government. The combination of being subsidized by the government, subsidized by the gaming industry, at least in the nascent stages here, only 4 years removed from that Supreme Court decision. Are we emphasizing the goods that are not goods?
Who's going to go tell Pete Rose?
Right. Tom in Blue Island, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, Dan, John, always great to hear you. The government's already parasitic, Dan, right? So they may as well get into the gambling business with the colleges. I tell you, I used to bet college and pro sports every weekend. I'll tell you, the thing that gets you the most is it's all you're thinking about all week is what games you're going to bet on the following week and stuff. And I think that's the last thing that college kids need. But a quick story. When I was married, I lived by Midway Airport, and Dan was betting with the Berwyn bookie, and he came to the house one day to collect, you know, and my wife answered the door. He's in a Cadillac and, you know, dressed to the nines, told me he's opening a club in Berwyn, and, you know, he got his money. And the next week, my wife said she never wanted to see him at the door again. So the next week, I had to meet him in Berwyn to collect a little money from him. The guy he looked like five guys stomped on his head for an hour, and he was driving a green Dodge Neon. Talk about the rise and fall.
Well, he who gambles lives in shambles, as it goes, right? Unless you're Teddy KGB.
Oh, yeah. Then the Democrats love you.
I was splashed the pot. Monica and Lyle.
Hi. I thought I'd go on a cheery note. So, okay. Dan, when you moved out, was the only thing that in your cabinets then the Jameson and the sangria that I gave you for your birthday 2 years ago?
I have a healthy stock of spirits, Monica. Don't you worry. Yes, I took them with me.
He drinks only 120 Life, Monica.
Yeah.
120 Life and vodka.
Right. Yeah, right. Yeah. 120. I drink 120 Life with the vodka IV in my arm. Ken in Evanston.
Oh, hi, Dan.
Hey.
I'm calling about your Stephen Moore interview. I noticed that you discussed three topics. You were right on two of them. Or no, I'm sorry. You were wrong on two of them, but you were right on one of them. And I'd just like you to explain yourself. You were right on immigration. You were blatantly wrong on the other two. My question is, whom do you serve?
I have...
Satan?
No. So what two was I wrong on? And then I guess I could answer the question, whom do I allegedly serve? I serve God. Who do you...
Right. You were right on immigration, and you were blatantly and obviously wrong on the economy and student loan.
How was I blatantly and obviously wrong? Explain to me.
Well, you're a supply-sider. Supply-side has been debunked for 20 years. It's a nutcase cult.
Hey, so Ken, so on student loans, so you favor the socialization of student loans?
Those fees never should have been imposed in the first place.
See you, Ken. So I make a deal. I sign a contract to borrow money and make a commitment to pay off on a particular schedule. But because it shouldn't have been that way, I don't have to pay anymore. You're going to have a real hard time enforcing contracts if you can have the government step in between contractual parties when one uses the government to like the terms after all. So just obviate the contract. Is that how we should run a private economy? Is that how we should organize society, Ken and Evanston? I don't even understand what you're talking about. What an absurd statement. I assume you call yourself some sort of populist conservative type, and you favor the socialization of obligations voluntarily undertaken? Okay, Ken, get back to your chalkboard or coloring book, as the case may be. Kevin in Austin, Texas.
Hey, good morning, Dan. I just wanted what the gambling thing is going to generate is gambling degenerates. Anyhow, I want to make a comment on that. My experience I had as a precinct captain in Williamson County, Texas, last week. It was the Tuesday when Trump announced, and so the executive chair was showing like the map of Williamson County, which is kind of, you know, it's just north of Austin, which would be kind of like a DuPage, right? Showing where it was red, where it was blue, where we got to focus our efforts to get people who don't vote a lot out to vote to help the Republicans win. Well, then they announced that Trump was going to run again. Half the room cheered. The other half like gave a big sigh because they realized how much more difficult their job is to get people out to vote for Republicans. And I just want to encourage people locally. I grew up in Oak Park, Illinois. I actually worked for the city of Chicago one time, and I ran, I walked the precinct in Chicago. That's where some of the decisions are made as far as involvement on the ground. And I think because the efforts that you made, Pritzker's vote was down, how many hundreds of thousands? And then Bailey's was up. I think there is a move towards the right in Illinois. And I think for the next year, it's the time to build the party from the ground up and the bottom up. And your fellow travelers, people who listen to you on your show, listen to John Cass, if they get involved in that, then they'll be ready to go out, know who their neighbors are. And that's the thing. You just know it's a small little neighborhood. You know who the neighbors are who think like you do, but they may think they're Democrats because they've been under the news media in Chicago for so long. Anyhow, I'd love to hear what your ideas.
Thanks for the call, Kevin. Yeah, I mean, I agree. Yeah, there are some green shoots there, and it is a manpower issue as well as a programmatic issue, and sort
school
of one boards. One school leads to the other. And, yeah, and school boards is the next beta test in terms of building, right? Rich, Indian Head Park.
Hey, good morning, John. Good morning, Dan.
Hey,
I just wanted to wish you and your family and Amy and her family and the 560 crew and all your listeners a happy Thanksgiving. And I hope everyone has a safe holiday. Thanks, and have a good rest of your day.
You too, Rich. Thanks for the call.
I'll be out in Indian Head Park on Thanksgiving.
Really?
My brother lives there.
Oh, he does?
Yeah.
Oh, interesting. All right. We'll say stop by Rich and Indian Head Park's place.
Yeah.
Everybody knows Rich and Indian Head Park.
Yeah.
Susan, Cedar Lake, Indiana.
Hi, guys. I've got a couple jokes for you. What was the turkey accused of?
What was the turkey accused of? I don't know.
Foul play.
Hi-o.
So, into rehab the day after Thanksgiving, as it turns out, he just couldn't quit cold turkey. You have a great weekend. Thanks, Dan. Big fan.
Hey, you too, Susan. Thanks for that. Susan's going to be the life of the party at her Thanksgiving.
She's my neighbor and lover. And remember, brine your bird, Susan. Brine the bird.
That's not a metaphor, is it?
You have to brine it. That's all there's to it.
Chuck in Delavan, Wisconsin.
Thank you very much for mentioning the name of my band, garage band, Brian Your Bird. Hey, I was going to say happy Thanksgiving to everybody, but Tom stole my thunder. Hey, tomorrow night, children, from 6 till 8, bottle shop, Mr. and Mrs. Claw. It's free. Bring your children if you're in the area, and it's in the back part of the old theater where the music, where the magic show used to be. And it'll be really exciting. The children can tell Mr. and Mrs. Claus what they want for Christmas.
All right. Thanks. The bottle top for the Colossus. Thanks for the call, Chuck. Dan and John Cass in for Amy J.
Listen to podcast of Dan and Amy from the AM 560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.